This is a story of different cultures coming together, and through the power of poetry, one seeker coming home in spite of many twists and diversions along the way. Gulna Sayed tells his tale in the Georgia Review and writes, "My cultural legacy has revealed itself to me in unexpected ways. As a child of immigrants who came from a community of once immigrants, I picked up some family mythologies by way of after-dinner stories and some traditions through our special occasion activities. Being Sayed meant being more than Indian and Muslim, but also we were descended from Persian missionaries. When Rumi came to me, he came not through any of my literary uncles or in my mother's bedtime stories, but through Coleman Barks on a shelf in the poetry aisle at a Barnes & Noble in Louisville, Kentucky. As a Gujarati Muslim, I'm not confident that my claim to Rumi will be well received, but in retrospect and in my own defense, I can say Rumi had always been there. Even before that day at the bookstore, he was in the Qawwali music my dad blasted in the minivan on road trips. He was in the metaphors for love drunkenness in Bollywood songs. And he was in the Sufi celebrations that my father's side of the family adhered to back home. The American, not Indian college freshman I was didn't realize any of this. At the time, I was a student of literature in so much as I'd read a lot of Nancy Drew and a little less Dostoevsky and Donne. I had yet to meet the writers who named and explored familiar to me experiences of dissonance as an American. Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, Toni Morrison. When I serendipitously picked up the book that led me to begin naming my own brand of dissonance, Coleman Barks' Rumi, The Book of Love. I cannot tell you now exactly what words I read standing in the poetry aisle, likely with a latte in one hand and the book open in the other. I do know I did not buy the book that day, but went home with a new name at my lips, Jalaluddin Rumi. 4 years after, I read his poems online, specifically seeking out versions by Barks. Unlike more literal translators, Barks made available Rumi's emotional depth, the breathlessness of free verse, the vague, incessant longing for the beloved, the unexpected imagery of markets, moons, and rooftops. All of these felt at once familiar and distant, offering up to me what I did have and what I might have had. This Rumi fit me like an overstretched glove, a provision of warmth within distorted contours, too tight in some spaces and loose in others. I still don't quite know what to make of the circumstance. A white American man brought me something that, if not for a painful history of physical, economic, and epistemic violence and displacement, should have been mine. I feel only an empty non-loss at not having a thing I never had, but maybe could, maybe should have had. Coleman Barks has been criticized for appropriating, simplifying, and erasing the Islamic and historical underpinnings of Rumi's work. Intellectually, I understand this and am deeply uncomfortable with any work that repackages and decontextualizes non-Western cultural production for Western mass consumption. Experientially, Barks' works did not reduce my understanding of Islamic literature to an appreciation of lovely words, an exercise in mindfulness, or an exploration of desire. I read Barks as a comfortable and devout Muslim, not as a New Age seeker of spirituality, but as a seeker of voice. Finding Rumi led me back to my father's Qawwali CDs, and to understanding that Bollywood made more than musical rip-offs of Western films. Rumi led me to Omar Khayyam and Hafiz, and to Tagore and Mirza Ghalib, led me not only to great literature, but but to an exploration of the breadth of Islamic religious practices and historical experiences. I must and do critique the context that shaped the moves that led me to a childhood embedded in an adopted culture, mine by birth in a time and place, but not by legacy. I found Rumi by way of Coleman Barks, by way of the conquests and losses of history. Decisions made by empires, by corporations, by families, and by other people led me to that bookshelf in that poetry aisle at that Barnes & Noble in Louisville, Kentucky. Not a direct road to Rumi, perhaps, but one that ended by illuminating other paths I had missed because I'd chosen not to look and because they'd been deliberately obscured from my view. I still return to Barks Rumi when my mind feels unsettled and begins buzzing. The words searched for on my iPhone or at my bedside in the books I've now purchased remind me to celebrate the momentous occasion of simply existing. With these words, I make sense of my experiences. Words of Gulnaz Syed in the Georgia Review in 2016. We're invited to encounter the poetry of Rumi in an evening of words and music at the Rossetti House in Scranton, Saturday, August 9th at 6 in the evening. The program is presented by The Old Stories with special guidance by Melinda Crocus. Dr. Crocus teaches comparative religion courses at Marywood University, focusing on themes such as nature, ecology and environmental justice, health and healing, and women and gender studies. Her research specialization is in Islam, with a particular interest in the Sufi tradition, and her ethnographic fieldwork has taken her to Turkey, South Africa, Mauritius, and different parts of Europe, examining the intersection of sacred text, lived religious experience, and the poetry that emerges from that encounter. Musician Jason Smeltzer, founder and artistic director of The Old Stories, and Elle, musician and reader, stopped in at the WVIA Benko studio to fill us in on the program.
This project began with the meeting of Melinda Crocus. I ran into her at a classical guitar concert, and she was reading some primarily Middle Eastern poetry in between here and there. And to me, it was a nice touch, even though it wasn't necessarily two things that related. So since she was a bit of a misfit, I like to say that I accosted her afterwards, and you could tell that she was grounded in something that you usually don't see grounding in. She was doing a Rumi and things of that sort, and also had a little handout that went along with it. So I revealed to her that I was interested because many years ago, I had studied Middle Eastern dance and some Middle Eastern music and got away with things that I was not familiar with, but had a fearless leader at the time named Diana Shehane. She came to this area. She was from this area, moved to Egypt, was married in Egypt, and she wound up back in this area to take care of her mom. And we just happened to join forces. I just loved that I had known Diana for only about 2 weeks. And she knew that I had organized a few dance things, had done a little bit of this and that, but also knew that I played some strange instrument. And with only that foundation, and I'm fun when you meet me, but still, it's hard to quantify what is possible. The strange instrument being a theremin, which is about as un-Middle Eastern as you can ask for. Someone had given her a spot at an event called Rakasa, which at the time was the largest Middle Eastern dance festival on this coast.
They have two. There's the West Coast and the East Coast one. So we performed on stage with Diana at the Rakasa as her musical accompaniment. What's great about Rakasa is it allows for experimentation because the way they do their performances, it's a call-in, so it's first come, first serve. So that means that all different skill levels, all different styles of dance. And if you want to try something new, it's like that's definitely the stage for it.
So anyway, with this Middle Eastern platform, we had our fearless leader at the time. Diana is no longer with us, I'm afraid. But forward fasting to meeting Melinda, the other end of the Middle Eastern spectrum was, I'd always been introduced to the Middle Eastern poets like Rumi and Hafez, but if you know what you don't know, you need a guide for that. If you don't speak the Persian language, you're going to miss almost every aspect of what it is, and it'll just be words. And Melinda had that. And somehow I convinced her that this was the next step. So basically, we put together this program of a lot of people that none of us had worked together before. Elle is the only person on the program that I even know. Most of them have never done anything before, but how it fell into place was that after meeting Melinda, I was at this interesting venue called the Rossetti Foundation, or the Rossetti House, or the Rossetti Estate, which is in downtown Scranton. And they have a tendency towards the opera vocal crowd. And there's one woman there I know, Anne-Marie Dupre, who just happened to mention that she's 50% Lebanese. And she started referencing all these foods and arts and things like that. And this was new to me. And I believe it was the same night where a woman came in who looked like she was taking the Rossetti in. You could tell she'd never been there and was just trying to process it.
It's very overwhelming, and stylistically, there's a grandeur to it.
Right. And so when I see a person looking lost, I try to demystify things a little bit. That's a key word even to this show, is trying to demystify mystic poetry and so forth. But anyway, I said, so what are you doing here? What's going on, Francie? And she said, well, I used to be a dancer, and you wouldn't size her up as a Middle Eastern dancer. She's very Irish. And so what kind of dance? And she said, Middle Eastern. And basically from there, here we go. She's no longer dancing. She's actually from Virginia, but she was able to bring in a lot of expertise in color and so forth that started making all of this make sense. And there again, Elle and I will confess that Middle Eastern poetry is a new ocean for us, which is why we like our fearless.
Yeah, I would agree.
We're basically depriving you in this interview of not having Melinda, because she would be able to hone all the vocabularies and all the distinctions. And we're focusing on Rumi and Hafez because they're probably the most established, the most well-known.
And there has been, for maybe decades now, a revival in interest in Coleman Barks' mm-hmm. translations, and people seeming to be searching and being drawn to these words because somehow, don't they sound contemporary?
I don't know if I know enough of the cultural aspects to fully appreciate all the nuance, but there is something. Most of it is about the connection with the divine. So I feel it's very relatable in that aspect to anyone who's sought out the spiritual life, that you are always searching for that connection. And I think there is its accessibility.
Do you have an example, Elle?
There's one that I quite enjoy. I actually came across it when I first started dancing, and it is a poem by Rumi, and it goes, "Dance when you are broken open. Dance if you've torn the bandage off. Dance in the middle of the fighting. Dance in your blood. Dance when you're perfectly free."
Did that poem inspire your dance in any way?
I would say absolutely, because it was something I did for myself. So it's about dancing regardless of how you feel about it, especially the line, dance in your blood. You know, so passionate, you're bleeding out your emotions and you can dance. And it's a way of expressing your emotions, your feelings beyond words.
You had mentioned Coleman Barks, and while this reference is in my head too, it was probably in a documentary, and I believe he was referencing Rumi, but it could have been anything. And it came down to, there's a lot about severing. Like, there's a very popular Rumi poem about the reed flute and how it's so plaintive. And part of that is that to make a reed flute, you sever it from its reed bed, and then every sound it makes is like wanting to go back. And Coleman Barks had a really beautiful reference at one point where the fact that we need language is proof that we're not connected. And the further you think about that, there's a beautiful accuracy to it. So we have these sounds that connect us invisibly because we're not connected otherwise, hence the reed bed or anything like that. It's just this infinite circle. Love that.
And the severing, and then the longing for the divine. Because if we're severed from each other, we are longing then for that connection with the lover, right? The lover,
right.
Who is the divine.
Yes. Often Rumi references the beloved, which they compare the desire for God or the divine with a person longing for their lover, for their beloved. And so, again, very relatable and accessible. And it's that longing, that desire for connection.
And Jason, when you think about that Coleman Barks comment about language, what does that say to you as a musician? What role then does music have for us?
Back to the reed flute. sometimes there's no verbal equivalent. You just know there's a plaintive wanting to be back. An interesting tie back to dance as well is also that in another severing situation was when Rumi's, his teacher, who may have just disappeared, when he was severed from his teacher, that's when Rumi inadvertently developed the whirling dervish. He just wound up spinning, and he basically grabbed onto a column and just started going around in a circle. And that also released poetry from him for quite a substantial period of time. So the dance kind of led, all these things led together, but there's always that severing. And also musically, it's not a direct tie-in, but my understanding is Hafez, during a significant period of his life, governmentally, the politics of the time basically made music illegal, or it was very much suppressed. And a lot of the Middle Eastern tendencies is the music is always supporting some other discipline, whether it be poetry, dance.
El, you have an example from your own experience of what Jason just laid out.
I had tried my hand at pharaonic style dance, which is a type of belly dance, but the movements are inspired by ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. So I had chosen a piece that was from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. So I had someone read the work while I performed the movements that looked like the hieroglyphs of the piece. And so I feel like that ties in with what we're doing, because we're playing music over more poetry, you know, the combination of everything, like the visual aspect with the music and the words will blend together very nicely, I think.
We haven't mentioned the century or the centuries that we're talking about.
So Rumi is 1200s in that area. Hafez is about 100 years later in the 1300s. We will be also doing some more recent, you know, others. One of my favorites to throw in, who I can relate to more immediately, is Gurdjieff, just because he was a troublemaker, a little more 20th century, and you can relate to his troublemaking. Yes and no. I should make that distinction too, because you can't quite figure him out, but you can figure out that you can't figure him out. So we will have a little bit of Gurdjieff in there.
Who created music as well.
As well. Good point.
And so as you all come together and have this circle dance that you're doing in the creation of the event, what are the key elements? Not necessarily that you have the order locked in and maybe you'll be free-spirited. Will you explain things, or will it be like a performance piece and then we'll just experience it? How is it coming together?
If you're familiar with some of my other storytelling things, usually it's pretty concise. In this case, the way the Rossetti is situated, I anticipate it being much less formal, a little less of a captive audience, and come and go as you please. Some of the pieces I have reliably situated. We have a couple things planned, but we very much anticipate improvisation and reading things that we didn't plan on, possibly even have readers who we didn't plan on. And mainly the musical foundation is the traditional drum of the Middle East is the dumbek. So we have two dumbek, among other percussive things going on. I will have a santur, which is a Middle Eastern dulcimer type instrument. Also, of course, theremin. That's my trademark troublemaking thing that surprisingly is effective in Middle Eastern music and poetry and so forth. And it doesn't hurt to have a gong or two. We'll also have some weird Moog synthesizer type things. But basically, there'll be a heavier than usual musical backdrop in most cases for most pieces. Half improv and some will be situated.
What do you look forward to doing as part of this event, Al?
Oh, I'm very much looking forward to playing my dumbek. I met with Daniel Singer, who's our other dumbek player, a very lovely gentleman and very creative. So we had a good rapport when we were practicing. We were just seeing how the music would flow, listening to each other, getting used to that. And I think we play off each other well. So I think it'll be a fun bit of performance art. And I feel like Diana would approve.
Most importantly. When I had a little meeting with Melinda one-on-one, she was wondering about practices and some things like that. And this is an interesting situation where a lot of people are new to me, or if they're not, I haven't done that much with them, much less something like this. And I do like the platform, which may almost be like a Gurdjieff type sensibility, where if it's possible to have a show be as unknown and unlikely as possible, you only have one chance to absolutely not know what you're doing. And often that is where the magic comes. or the surprises. Another adage of mine is to always set yourself up for failure. There's a magic to that, and it's surprising how effective that philosophy is if you can make others comfortable with it.
I know you danced, but how did you come to the rumba?
My first dance teacher had actually mentioned to me that some of the best dancers she knew also played drum to familiarize themselves with Middle Eastern rhythms. And so I had bought one to practice and start learning, and I was lucky enough to take some workshops with some very talented players. And what's great about learning it on the Dumbek is it translates to other instruments as well. When I'm playing the finger cymbals or the rick, which is a tambourine, it's the same hands. So everything you would do on the left or right hand on the drum translates to the other instruments. And then it makes it useful for when Jason has these projects and he has a Middle Eastern percussionist he can call on.
Will you play for us here?
We do have a little santur in the studio, if you would like.
Please.
This is a Middle Eastern instrument called the santur. It's in the dulcimer family, but it tends to have many more strings. There's about 100 strings on here.
This time. The sun never says to the earth, "You owe me." Look, what happens with a love like that? It lights the whole sky.
There's something mysterious about that, a haunting feeling. You used the word earlier, Jason, mystic, mystical, will be demystifying. Mystical is often a term used in and around poets like this, getting into a state of dervishdom when you might transcend your ego or you might become one with the divine or that beloved in a way. Is that a consideration? You'll just leave it to us to be moved or not?
I can kind of tie that in. It might even be a little bit of a philosophy of mine where, you know, there's a lot of mystery out there, and there's a lot of things to be mystified by. And some friends of mine that I always talk with, because I like jumping into oceans of mysterious things, but I'm also very, I would maybe even say severe about demystifying what can be demystified. And usually then that leaves room to be mystified by things that are worthy of mystification. Because there's a lot of nonsense out there that you can stare at something and be as mystified as you want. You can be mystified by music, but if you don't learn anything about it, it's very mysterious. But once you do, there's always mystery after that. So the more you demystify, the stronger your foundation is. And the same as this, and that's for me very much where Melinda comes in. Just because she's grounded in it, it's her religion, and as long as she doesn't turn me around and say, "You are pointed in the wrong direction," which hasn't happened yet, but I'm always ready. I'm always ready to be, slapped on the wrist a little bit, but just pay attention, and usually you can demystify what is there to be demystified, and we hope to do that for the audience. A lot of the things I've done are not anyone's thing necessarily, but we try to open it up to where now you can get it or at least grapple with it.
I once spoke with a Buddhist monk who said that Buddhism is like a buffet table. And if something resonates with you, you can take it and use it, but you don't have to throw the rest away. You might come back to it later. So I feel like this could be an experience like that, where there might be pieces that resonate with someone. And if they don't get the rest, they don't have to throw it away. Maybe they can come back to it later.
Tell us a little bit, what is the Rossetti Mansion?
The Rossetti House is located on Vine Street in Scranton, and it is currently open as an Airbnb, if I'm not mistaken. So it is open for people to stay there. It is a beautiful residence, very large, spacious, so many artistic details. You could spend hours just examining the nooks and crannies of everything, all the details, the molding, the paintings, the features, and it seems like it encapsulates all different time periods. So almost as the people who have taken residence in the house, they just keep adding. So it doesn't always seem to be one cohesive theme, but there's something beautiful about that. And it's still classy, and Ken does switch out the artwork based on what artists he's presenting. So it's always different every time you see it.
And is there a performance space? I know you're going to be relaxed.
There's basically one more open room than the rest of it. You sort of have to make it work a little bit, like it's not a theater so much, but that's sort of the informality of it, where it's less of a captive audience situation. The Rossetti had sort of had, up to the pandemic, it had sort of a performance venue where it was lavishly decorated. And then when Ken took it over, he liked the history of it. And I like how Ken has said he's just interested in creating experiences. He doesn't really have a specific agenda or anything like that. And if he can make sense of it at all, then he will help you put it together.
Well, let's close with date and time.
So we will be at the Rossetti House on August 9th. Doors open at 6 o'clock, and it'll probably be about 2 hours worth of material, but you never know. Well, you never know. And there again, food will be supplied by Madonna's. It's 1005 Vine Street, Scranton, PA. And there again, this is a benefit for the Rossetti Estate. So admission is free, but donations are appreciated.
Musician Jason Smeltzer, founder and artistic director of The Old Stories, and L, musician and reader, speaking about a program titled Nefarious Musical Accompaniment for the Mystic Poetry of Rumi, Hafez, and Others, to take place Saturday, August 9th, 2025, at 6 p.m. at the Rossetti House, 1005 Vine Street in Scranton. There will be readings, and there will be musical accompaniment for those readings and special guests. The program is a benefit for the Rossetti Foundation for the Arts and Culture. Admission is free, but donations are welcome. For more information, on the web, rossettiarts.org, rossettiarts.org. RossetTi. That's Saturday, August 9th at 6 in the evening at the Rossetti House, 1005 Vine Street in Scranton, presented by The Old Stories, RossettiArts.org.